Everyone has a fave Wendy's Frosty flavor. And when you're choosing from chocolate or vanilla, it's not that hard. But now there's all new Frosty Swirls and Frosty Fusions. So try picking your fave from Oreo Brownie Fusion, Pop-Tarts Strawberry Fusion, Strawberry Swirl, Brownie Batter Swirl, Caramel Swirl, and Caramel Crunch Fusion. Not so easy now, huh? For a fresh way to Frosty, gotta be Wendy's. Open till midnight or later.
At participating U.S. Wendy's, hours may vary by location. Oreo is a trademark of Mondelez International Group. Pop-Tarts is a trademark of Kellogg North America Co. LLC. Used with permission.
Hello everyone and welcome to Turned Out a Punk, and today on the show, huge guest from the band The Fix, one of the first and greatest hardcore vocalists in my opinion, Steve Miller is on the show. Steve Miller is also an incredible author, having written books on Touch and Go, Detroit Rock City. He has a brand new book on the Laughing Hyenas, which is coming out on a very cool new publisher called J-Card Press. This is a fantastic book. I think it's one of my favorite books of the year, as I tell Steve in a second on the show. You got to check this thing out yourself. You can find it now available for pre-order. The link will be in the description of this show. As for Steve Miller himself, you can check out Fix's music on streaming. I think, hopefully, that Touch and Go LP is available still. That reissue that they did of Jan's Room and Vengeance, and also the Comptracks on there. If you have a lot of money, you can buy an original of Vengeance. If you have a lot of money, you can buy me an original of Vengeance. I'd love that. But check out his music. Check out the Strange Ways stuff, too, we talk about on the show. Check out the Steve Shelley episode. We talk a lot about Steve on the Steve Shelley from Sonic Youth episode way back when. I'm just rambling now. You can get in touch with the show at turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. Find us at Turned Out a Punk on various social media platforms. We put up videos and things like that. The show is produced and booked by my brother, Tristan Abraham. Thank you, Tristan. And now kick back, relax, and enjoy Steve Miller on Turned Out a Punk. Steve, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as we're just talking off air, this has been a long time coming, but I got to say, I didn't say this to you off air. You're one of the greatest hardcore vocalists, punk rock vocalists of all time. So this is a huge thrill to get to do this with you.
All right. Thank you.
Well, outside of that, too, I think you're an incredible author. So I feel like the Laughing Hyenas book is like the confluence of these two, you know, like John being one of the great vocalists of all time. I think you can write about that band, obviously having a lip perspective being around it, but in a way that I don't think any other person could really understand it.
Maybe I don't know. I always figure if there's a book you want to read, you should probably write it oftentimes. And the Hyenas were vastly underrated. So, and then of course the book came about because I met up with John somewhere, I think here in Dallas, and he told me about the live LP coming out on Third Man. And then this publisher kind of popped up, and I had some liberty because of another project that I could do something that was more artistic, I suppose. And so that it just made sense. And so we struck a deal, and so hopefully this will help drive awareness of the Hyenas into that album release.
Well, I want to talk to you all about the book, because I do think it's like one of my top books of this year. I know it's on track to be, but I got to start this off the way they all start off, which is, Steve, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
Punk, I suppose. Well, I mean, the first time I really got, I was made aware that there was this music that was different, I was seeing Blue Cheer on Upbeat in 1968. And I suppose that was the first time I saw music. I was 10. First time I ever saw music that gave me both courage and comfort But I didn't know that at the time. Later on, I would be realizing that. So that was the first time. There's Blue Cheer doing Summertime Blues on Upbeat. I think it was a show out of Cleveland on a Saturday afternoon. And then the real punk rock, I think, that you speak of would be the Stranglers at Dooley's in East Lansing, Michigan, 1978 April. And then 2 weeks later, the Ramones.
How much awareness did you have as a young person of kind of the Detroit rock stuff? I guess it's now been much more fabled than it was probably as it was going on.
Lots of, you grow up as a teenager, as an adolescent, and you're immediately, if you like music and you're not into what everybody else is into, you like the Stooges, and the Stooges were the big one. That was the one that made you, you know, like everybody else is fawning over Mick Jagger and so on. And you're going Iggy Pop, you know, we got Iggy Pop. And so that was, it made a difference because music was all around you. I was a kid growing up in East Lansing. And so you'd have bands coming through town. I remember going by a high school when I was just a kid, like maybe, you know, 11 or 12. And Ted Nugent was playing there. And, you know, the Amboy Dukes. And so it just was part of the fabric if you were paying attention. I was lucky growing up in East Lansing. A college town, when college towns were really college towns, we had a club at the end of the block of where I lived. And I remember I went and saw the Box Tops there one afternoon. They had a matinee. And so all this music is always coming through. And so you're always, there were outdoor concerts. We had, you know, so you'd go to all this stuff as a little rambunctious little kid. And then, of course, you start reading reviews and Stereo Review and so on and things like that. And you'd see other bands from Detroit that you'd think, wow, this must be something else.
I guess a lot's been made about, you know, the industry of Detroit being what kind of causes this music. But like outside of sort of these existential factors, was it like radio? Was like there a lot of radio support for these local bands that were kind of happening?
Yeah, because at the time radio was wide open. So you had in Detroit, you had W4WABX, WRIF. Even in Lansing, we had I hate to call it underground, but we had a station where you could hear the Dolls. You could hear Iggy and the Stooges. And in fact, the first time I ever heard Iggy and the Stooges was on a music bed for a live show, an advertisement on the radio for a live show they were doing locally. And I was in driver's training and I nearly drove off the road. You know, he let us, our cool driving instructor, Earl Hadinger, let us have the radio on while we drove. But that threw me off, you know.
So how popular was this stuff amongst kids at this point? Because, like, you know, I see the concert footage and obviously, like, Iggy standing on top of the Hands in Cincinnati with the peanut butter. Or you see the footage of the MC5 playing. But, like, was it popular amongst your peers or were you kind of, like, in the rough on this?
In the rough, there were probably a group of four or five of us that dug the sounds, you know, and then again, you'd listen to that stuff and go to school and it would definitely put you in a different space. And you realize that you were just listening to that music made you a little different, not, you know, because you're thinking different. It wired your brain a little different.
I heard you on a radio show on WFMU playing some music and you played a track by Go. And to me, they're like one of the most obscure of the sort of the big three Detroit bands, but incredible band, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. They were, think about all those bands that didn't, you know, you always say, why didn't they make it? Or why didn't they, I don't know what making it is, but they just didn't have the higher profile that, you know, staying in Detroit does that to you.
Yeah, there was like a Kill by Death type compilation of Detroit rock that someone put out. I think there's two volumes of it. And it's wild when you're going through that. You're like, oh my God, all these bands should have been huge.
Yeah. Yeah, they should have been huge. At least they just should have gotten a wider audience. I mean, huge is relative. Should they have been, you know, should
huge they have been huge to me. What about a band like Death? You know, obviously they've become kind of like enshrined in the pantheon at this point, but I you don't really see too much of them playing shows with these bands back then. I think they would have been a little bit later, maybe even temporarily.
I think so, because I remember I did a story for somebody and talking to the guys from Death, or one of the guys from Death, I think Bobby, I can't remember. And he talked about going to see Thin Lizzy at Ford Auditorium. And so my, that puts them, what, about 75, 76. So they were a little later. And, you know, who knows why they flew under the radar? I mean, that seems odd. And at first you kind of go, well, are they, is this something that they're constructing? But clearly they were around. And there are probably a lot of bands that probably were great and played in their basement for nobody, for their friends, which is kind of sad.
Well, it's, I think it speaks to just the amount of records that were coming out of there, not to underscore the fact that death was kind of overlooked, but at the same time, like, there's just so many great, like we're talking about, so many great records that are coming out. Like, I guess it's post Rolling Stones, American garage rock, but in Detroit, it just took on a spirit of its own.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you start with one, you know, you start with one band and you go see another, and it's just the Ramones effect.
Yeah. It seems like the New York Dolls though had kind of like a overstated impact on at least that first wave of punk rock, which I know a lot of the Detroit sort of more classic punk rock people seem to really dislike, but I love like Cinecide and 27 and Cold Cock and Mutants and all those bands.
Yeah. Yeah. I loved Cold Cock in particular. I thought were terrific. That was one of the first bands that we saw when we started going to shows at Bookies. It was Cold Cock. I thought they were fantastic. And, you know, obviously they were playing a lot because the guitar player was active in the booking scene. But there's also a kind of a divide that post MC5 Stooges thing that took shape at Bookies. There were great bands in there, but it seemed to be overlooked as well. I don't think they were as ambitious as everybody else, aside from, say, the Romantics.
Talking to John Brannon, there's definitely like a real vitriol that he seems to feel towards these bands. And it kind of even comes across in that Detroit documentary that there's like a hard divide between the stuff that came before the hardcore stuff or what gets labeled the hardcore stuff.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And then, then as the hardcore kids started coming in, it kind of took over. And I think that it was like they actually were an old guard by then, like the Bookies scene. It was more of an old guard, and more kids started getting into it, and they're like, these damn kids, you know.
It's interesting because it seems to happen, well, like you even talk about it, I think, in Tony Rettman's book, after a certain point, it kind of happening in Detroit with like this next wave of hardcore kids coming in and kids being less into the music and more into sort of the social scene or the social aspect of hardcore.
Yeah, that's right. You'd see people that just wanted to talk punk, and, you know, and it was just the same as any other high school.
Yeah.
And so that seems to take a lot of the fun out of it.
It really is interesting though, because you guys are like one of the first American hardcore scenes, and to see that natural evolution that just seems to perpetually happen in punk and hardcore, where you have a wave of kids who are like, were the punk, not the stuff that came before us. And then they go through it and then they age through it. And there's another group of kids that will come up and be like, no, we're the punk. Those guys had no idea what they were talking about. And I love Detroit because it's almost like sedimentary rock when you start going through all these different layers, because they were all so distinct and there's not a lot of bleed over between the two.
No, but speaking about, you know, like we're the punk, you know, they were there. I love that idea because when you're a kid, you should feel like that, you know, we're the ones. You know, fuck them. You know, I kind of like that.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's like, it can be a negative energy, obviously the violence and things like that, certainly. But like you're saying, there's a renewal that happens because of that. And that's why this thing, we're still talking about it. How many years after you guys did that tour?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I can't even believe it. I had to brush up. Looking at your archive, I'm like, okay, these are bands I don't know. You know, but that's all right.
Well, believe me, we can just stick to the bands, you know, because I'm that's very okay. Excited to talk about all those ones, especially because it's you brought up the Stranglers as being like the first show that you went to. And they're an interesting band because I feel like within that London scene, they were kind of controversial because they were looked at being part of this old guard for the younger punk kids. But in the same way that I love Cinecide and all these Detroit punk rock, capital R rock bands, when you're removed from the context of being there with something, it's just the music that you're kind of left with.
Oh yeah, that's all we cared about, really. I mean, to see them play, and you know, you go to we went to this little place, and there's a they had the venue had actually put chairs on the floor, on the dance floor, like people were going to sit down. The first thing Cornwell said when he walked out is like, get rid of those chairs, you know, everybody get up here. And we're like, okay, because if you're weaned on, I'd been going to some club, right? I mean, I saw Patti Smith at a little club and saw the Tubes at a little club, but for the most part, we'd gone to Cobo Hall, Masonic Auditorium, Ford Auditorium, see shows. And to have somebody do that was so refreshing, and how cool, and we're all in this together, that kind of stuff. And then for them to be able to, you know, to just blast through this music. We'd already had it was the second album was already out. So we had the first two albums, so we're familiar with the material. And it was unbelievable. It was just you really blew your wig back, man. You couldn't understand what you were seeing almost. But we got out of there. Me and I went with Mike Ochtenberg, who was my roommate and high school friend, and eventually the bass player in The Fix. And we said to each other, we go, well, we got to get a guitar. And the next day we went to Kmart and bought this little Japanese-made thing with a single coil on it and really high action. So we tried to play it, and our fingers would be like aching. And what, is this supposed to be like this? And you know, we suffered for our art, for our ineptitude, I guess.
Was it immediate for you guys? Like after seeing that Strangler show, were you just kind of like going to punk shows from that point on, or are you still
Oh,
trying to
yeah.
keep one foot in the rock kind of world?
Well, we still love rock, but that was just rock. You know, so seeing the Ramones 2 weeks later, so we had the guitar. Seeing the Ramones 2 weeks later, then we kind of go, well, we can do that. We could play those songs possibly, you know.
Yeah, I think that's a great. Brilliant thing about the Ramones is because like when you actually try and sit down and learn those songs, they're way more complicated than they appear at first blush, but
Oh, yeah.
the deception is that anyone can do this, and that's what makes it a magical thing.
Right. And then think about it, that Johnny was inspired by seeing Slade at someplace in New York and thinking, well, I can do that.
It's also interesting because I think Johnny talks about it somewhere. You did the book, so you would know better than I, but the dogs from Detroit were like a weird influence on Johnny during their brief time in New York. He saw them play and
Right.
apparently was inspired by them just wearing their street clothes on stage.
Right. Yeah. Which, of course, the Ramones didn't do, but yeah. I mean, that's another element I think of the music. And again, going back to seeing the Stranglers, is Hugh Cornwell looked like he had just changed the oil on his car. And so you like that. But then seeing the Ramones, when they had the white lights that Arturo had taken from the Van Halen stage show, pretty sure that's right, at that time, 78, yeah. They look like cartoon characters. That's the first thing I thought. You couldn't understand, you couldn't hear a song, you couldn't tell what song they were playing. They're so loud, and they look like cartoon characters. And it was too good to be true.
That's a brilliant thing about punk is that it can be very silly and threatening at the same time. Like it's the only
Yeah.
genre that can really do that.
Oh, yeah. They were definitely both.
Yeah. And you see that with like later bands too. Even the New York Dolls, there's like a threat to that too, but there's also like a camp over the top
Right.
silliness to it. It's Stooges, like Iggy's rubbing peanut butter on himself, but he's also cutting himself. So there's like a constant walking between these two kind of like manias.
The great ones can pull it off.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what, like you talk about in that book, when there's a certain point where hardcore starts becoming too much about itself, which I think also is something that perennially kind of happens with punk and hardcore, or perpetually kind of happens with punk and hardcore, where eventually it starts taking itself a little too seriously and kind of leaves behind that sort of humor and self-awareness. And it kind of has to, the pendulum has to ultimately swing back the other way. And it kind of like, punk and hardcore kind of come back together again.
I hope so. I mean, I don't know. See, I don't know what I don't follow what goes on now so much. But yeah, ideally.
Well, it's interesting because it is something that still happens now. Like it is something that like almost like you guys could have written a handbook back then on how a scene will develop. And it just seems like you're saying, like it has to be like this. Kids have to be excited about it to keep it going. But there's almost like this is going to happen. This is just part of the natural life cycle. Like, no matter how committed you are to the hardcore and the purity of this thing, 10 years are going to go by and you're going to be like, what would happen if I started playing solos? Or what would happen if I got into this kind of music?
Yeah. Well, I want to think there's a kid, there's kids everywhere sitting in their bedrooms trying to learn, you know, Ramon songs or Lazy Cowgirl songs or Bad Brain songs.
Yeah. I also love the fact that you guys were so musical, like looking through that Touch and Go book that you helped put together. There's just so many weird bands that normally punk kids aren't necessarily leaning to, the industrial stuff, like stuff that would become, I think, more of an influence on you and Blight later on. But,
yeah. There's a wide swath of influences. And I mean, when we were in the Fix, I mean, we listened to Rush songs and I don't know if it shows up in the music. The opening to a song in the Fix we did called the Elite was stolen from the intro to Crash Street Kids by Mott the Hoople. And so, you know, we had all these wider, we just had a pretty big palette to choose from because we were all three, and Jeff, not as much, but we're musically diverse. We listen just wide. I mean, when we were recording Jan's rooms during the day, because we had to go in at night to get a cheaper studio time, I remember playing Monopoly and listening to Neil Young. You know, then, oh yeah, we got to go to the studio. You know, it wasn't an insincere, it was just stuff we liked. We had this very wide, wide selection that we, of music we love. It would just, we didn't put hardcore on the stereo all the time.
Well, it's especially those two bands, Rush and Neil Young, they're almost like proto-punk in their way. Like Rush opened for the New York Dolls the first time New York Dolls played Toronto. That first Rush record sounds like, it's like a hard rock record.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can always win a bet who was the first Rush drummer. But yeah, it's true. In New York, I didn't know the New York Dolls opened for, or the Rush opened for the Dolls in Toronto, because they did that in Michigan as well at a drive-in theater.
Oh, weird. Maybe they did shows together along the
same Booker. I don't know.
Yeah. Because it's obviously things get codified and eventually everything kind of fits into a slot, but when those bands are first coming out, there's something revolutionary about Rush and the New York Dolls that's no one else is doing it like that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. All the pioneers are like that, right? Yeah, they're carving their own path. And I don't know. Well, Rush kept going. And of course the New York Dolls stopped just at the right time.
Mm-hmm. In the book, you talk about when Craig came, or in not the book, in Why Be Something That You're Not, Tony Rettman's book, you talk about Craig coming to audition for the band and him being, you know, a different skill level than you two at this point. And you guys are having this conversation about why is he doing it? And you're like, I don't want to misquote you, but to paraphrase you, you're like, there's certain things that are motivating people beyond writing hit singles or success type, which I find it's such a thing that's central to punk. Like you're doing the thing in service to the thing.
That's exactly right. And I think Craig he was so talented even then. And we did. We wondered, like, why would he want to play with us? We don't have any experience. We don't know what we're doing. And yet Craig, you know, like you say, like, you know, you paraphrase, he just wanted to be part of something different, you know, and he saw it. He was smart enough to see, you know, that, despite our suckiness, that we might be able to do something.
I think also Dave Stimson in the book talks about, or you talk about Dave Stimson thinking you guys had an LA sound right out of the gate with your record.
Yeah.
Your live sound, I guess.
And we didn't even know that. Right. You know, so until Dave and Tesco brought over a bunch of the LA singles and said, listen to this. And we're like, oh, you know, it was, I see. And I don't know if they were trying to influence us or not, but I think probably more importantly, they were just trying to let us know, because it was clear we did not know.
And that was really the only way you'd hear about something like that back then, would be someone bringing it over and right. Actually playing it for you.
Right. Yeah. Come over with a big stack of records and some beer. And that's how it worked. Great education.
There's this amazing moment starting in about 74. And you see it, you know, like you're saying, it goes back further to the 60s, but like 74, you start seeing all these bands pop up around the world, like in Australia and England, in America and Canada, even, that are approaching rock and roll from like a very postmodern perspective. It seems like they all really understood music. Like a lot of them were rock critics or amateur rock critics in the case of Rock from the Tombs, even where people were just, they understood music and were going to take it to the same place. And there's no, like in the same way you had someone come over and show you these singles, you needed someone to show you this stuff. So it's fascinating that all this simultaneously kind of kicks off around the world with no connection to each other.
Yeah. I wonder why. I'm trying to think, I guess it's just maybe just part of being human. You want to find something more and you want to create, and you don't want to create something that's been already created. And so anything that would be different, especially if you're really bored with what's going on, it would move you to do something that was different. Then of course, in some cases, in our case, there was the lack of musical pedigree or history. You didn't grow up playing music. And then all of a sudden you're like, well, this guy, we could probably do this. So, but I think you're right. The more vastly, these were already accomplished musicians playing pretty good music. Even the New York Dolls were good musicians.
Oh yeah. Well, they all, I guess, and I even, it's like some of that first wave of the punk rock Detroit stuff, right? Like these guys had played in psych bands and hard rock bands before.
That's right. That's a good point. Those Detroit bands were really, a lot of those guys were really good.
Yeah.
In the case of the one thing that you had going for you when you were not as accomplished was dedication. So like a band like The Fix, we'd practice 6 days a week and we just show up and just do it. And it might even be at some points, if we weren't all living together, we had kind of a monkey's house like the Hyenas did, with three of us living there though. You just show up for the practice, you get it done, and then you just go your separate ways. But you had to do that practice. You'd load down in the little hole, you just jump down in the little basement and blow your eardrums out. And for a while afterwards, wherever you'd go, you couldn't hear that well, but you had to get it done.
It feels like, the legend is that Black Flag and DOA would come through town and would tell everyone how to tour and do this thing. But that seems to literally be what happened to you guys, like Black Flag and DOA together, kind of separately. Oh, right?
Yeah. Ken Lester from DOA. What happened was Black Flag played 1980, Black Flag played at Club Metro, I think, in Chicago. And the opening band was the Effigies. And I think it was the first Effigies show, maybe the second. Anyway, Jeff and I got in Jeff's Chevette, said, we're going to go down to Chicago and see these guys. And I'm going to talk to Chuck Dukowski, and I'm going to find out how to book bands, how you get. And that's what we did. I remember it was freezing cold. I think it was about the week before we recorded the first single. It was freezing cold. We went down there, went to the venue. Black Flag had two sets. They played, Effigies played first and Black Flag played. Then pretty sure between shows went backstage and met Chuck and exchanged numbers. And he was very helpful, very cool, very willing. And then, subsequently then we booked, I ended up talking to Chuck, and then Black Flag came through, had the whole powwow with the numbers. It was just all about phone numbers. And then that was March of 81. And then April of 81, then DOA came through, stayed at our house, and Ken Lester was there, did the same thing.
Was that the four-piece lineup of DOA when they had the two guitars? Do you remember?
Oh, man. It was Hardcore 81 tour.
Okay, yeah. So that would have been, it seems like that tour.
Dave Craig and Joey.
Yeah.
Both guitars.
Yeah. And everywhere they went, it just seems like it'd be at DC, obviously, be it you guys, like there's an energy that they're kind of giving. I think Black Flag gets a lot of credit for this, but I feel like DOA doesn't really get as much credit for being the band that inspired a lot of stuff.
They don't. And they were out. They were out before Black Flag, right? Nationally, I think.
I think they told Black Flag how to do that. That's the story I've always heard.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I never got the full picture. I just knew both of them were the people to see if you wanted to get numbers. It was all about the numbers. I still have the.
You've got it. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's got all the numbers. It's got all the numbers, and then it's got all the. It's the first tour. It's even got the, how much we got paid, and so on. which was not very much. But I mean, you're going to have a $125 night. That's a big night.
That's still a big night for some nights in a band, right?
Yeah,
now.
I guess it is. That's sad, isn't it?
It is. The economics has not increased that much. But
right.
What you guys were doing was creating a space for the quote unquote middle class band that I talk about on this show here. Like the idea that you can be a band, you don't have to be a huge pop band with radio support. You can be a band and just do this, follow the circuit that is kind of being laid out as you guys are touring. And that's the circuit the bands still kind of follow. And it's almost like something that was passed down from generation to generation. And eventually, like, be it a band like bands anywhere up to a stadium band, like be it a band like Superchunk or like a little tiny punk band, we're all kind of still doing the same thing and relying on a much slicker, slightly more professional version of the thing you guys started doing back then.
That's great to hear. I don't know. Is there still a circuit like that? So you don't have to play Live Nation, you know?
No.
That's real cool.
Yeah.
I went to something about 6 years ago in Los Angeles because Negative Approach was playing and I was in town. I texted John. I said, hey, I'm just going to come over. He's like, oh, there's like six bands. And I said, oh, boy, okay. So I went to this thing and it was a punk fest of some sort. And I watched one of the bands. It didn't do much for me, but I did think it was really cool. Although it seemed big and organized and more parental than before. But that maybe the crowd was younger, maybe because I was older. But I do think that the crowds were you got a little younger now. I don't know for sure.
Yeah, there's definitely like, I think because a lot of people that grew up in punk got to a position where all of a sudden they had a little bit of money or they had a good job where they could, you know, throw a sponsored show and have Negative Approach play. But there still is like, God, a couple of years ago, I did like a tour of a bunch of DIY shows and there were kids selling like whippets off the tables. Like it was very outlaw, very punk in sort of the classic interpretation of punk rock.
Good. I like to hear that kind of stuff going on. Yeah. I'm just not in touch with it, I suppose, but. Okay, that's really heartening to hear.
It's interesting because it is almost like a religion that's, you know, like people are proselytizing, coming to your town, being like, here's how we do this. Here's what we do.
Yeah.
And it's still a secular religion. Like it's still where kids turn to learn about morality in a world that's pretty amoral. Like you can learn a lot more from these sort of punk rock heroes, maybe not always with their actions, but certainly with their words than you could looking at a lot of politicians or like there's things that people get from punk rock that I think is what people get from religion. And I feel like this is for people that don't necessarily have that spiritual calling to find the same sort of community and sense of purpose.
Yeah. I think, well, whatever gets you through this, whatever 70, 80, 90 years is a, you know, it makes you feel good. That's pretty helpful. And if you can help other people, it's even better. Thinking about that, the lyric sheet to the Germs, GI, I remember reading that and just studying that and thinking, first of all, I could never write like this. This guy is hyper literate. But second of all, it's somewhat spiritual. Just reading that stuff, it really affected me. It really touched me. It was really, really, I still think about that. I still have it and still read it.
It's interesting you say that because Bill Stevenson from Black Flag Sends and All talked about how he used to carry that lyric sheet folded up in his pocket and like really? Would just kind of refer to it and read it like you would, I guess, a holy book.
That's odd. Okay. That's interesting. It's a great idea. It's really, recommended reading, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's like whatever gets you through these, you know, 70, 80, 90 years, like you're saying, but this is like the one way, and it's in a small way, just in terms of entertainment, but to gain power in that. Like, otherwise you're waiting permission from people to do things or you need help. But this is just saying, just do it. Like,
which is ridiculous to wait for permission. Yeah. Well, that's kind of going back to what I said, the courage and comfort, you know, is what it gives you. And that's a big help, especially when you're growing up.
Yeah, definitely. Ken Lester is someone that I'm really fascinated by. Like he's an ex-Yippie, really took DOA kind of under his wing. Some wild stories about him in Vancouver, passed away a couple of years ago, rest in peace. But
really? I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, there was someone, I don't want to cast dispersions on the dead, but there's someone who on the show said some you know, seen gossip stuff about what was going on back then. And so I feel like he's a guy who a lot of these yippie guys that just had like this really sort of noble intention looked at punk rock as being the next generation and kind of like tried to take it under their wing.
Yeah. Yeah. Russ Gibb was the same way in Detroit when he gave Corey Rusk a break, you know, to do that TV show. I think it was Why Be Something That You're Not. I don't know. I think I was out of it by then, but yeah, it's kind of these old hippie guys. As you say, yippie, I guess Ken Lester took it to the top, huh?
Yeah. He was, but there's like a few of them too. Like, what's the guy's name? Dave in New York. I'm blanking on his name now, but there was a yippie guy in New York. There was the Bad Brains used to practice at Madame Organ, which I guess was a yippie club.
Yeah, Madame's Organ was a kind of a funny little place. I'd been there too, but I think they played there too. They did some of their first shows there, right?
Yeah, I think that very first show is from there too.
Yeah.
And yeah. So yeah, like it's almost like this is kind of coming out of the wreckage of the 60s. Like we were talking about, like, why did it happen? It's almost like the 60s and the dream of the 60s crashed so horribly at the end of the 60s between Manson and Altamont and, you know, and people's cynicism towards government with Watergate and Vietnam. Like it feels like it was just ripe for youth to kind of take control and to do something.
Yeah, that's probably right. And plus, if you're sick of hearing what you're hearing, if you didn't like, or maybe you wanted to take it to a different level. I mean, I love Deep Purple and Black Sabbath, but I wouldn't want to play that kind of music, you know?
Yeah.
So you probably were doing on the artistic end, you were probably thinking, what could I do to fuck this up? You know, how can I fuck up Smoke on the Water? You know? And that to me was really, really the idea of, you know, having a lot of fun with music, with the craft itself.
I think out of all the early hardcore tours, your guys' tour is one of the most storied, from Pig Champion following the tour years later, trying to find copies of Vengeance that had been sent as promos or.
Yeah, that was great. That was really funny when you told that story about.
Yeah. Oh, it's incredible. Like, I feel like, but it's amazing how many people saw you guys on that tour. Jesse Michaels from Operation Ivy, when he was on here, talked about seeing you guys play, and
yeah,
it must've been San Francisco, maybe Berkeley, but out there. And
well, Eastern Front, probably.
Yeah, it was at the Eastern Front show. Absolutely.
Yeah. And we went on at like noon. And it was like, and it was funny because the show started, I think. We were like the third band in. And we had driven up from LA the night that we drove from LA from the session, from the Jan's Rooms session to San Francisco to play. I mean, I maybe we got some sleep on the drive. And just unloaded and played, and it was really bright. And when we started playing, all the kids started thrashing, and the dusk was coming up already. It was early. Later in the day, people kept playing. Later in the day, I ran into a Jack from TSOL, and he said something. We were talking about it, and he's like, "Yeah, you know, this music's like fireworks. It doesn't work if it's not nighttime." And I thought, that's fucking good, man. You ought to be a politician. And he was, I guess.
Yeah, if things had gone a different way, he could have been president now. And it would be also terrifying.
That'd be something else. You know, on that tour, we went over, we had a show at that tour. We had gone from Phoenix. We played in Phoenix with JFA. And we were driving to LA. And we're supposed to play at the Apollo with the Circle Jerks. And the show got canceled. We get there and the cops are there. And we're like, oh, shit, what are we going to do? And and so, you know, we really didn't know, you know, where we were going to go. But somehow we ran into somebody who said, and we said, well, we're going to stay at this place in Pacific Palisades. That's the house we were staying at when we were playing Monopoly during the day before we. But we also needed a place. There's somewhere in there. And I can't remember. I wish my memory were better, where we had to practice. And we didn't have a place. We didn't have a place to stay. And somebody said, TSOL lives in Long Beach, I think it was. And Jack has a studio place there where they practice. Turns out, and we made the connections, go over there. And it's his house, lives with his parents. And they have a little soundstage out back in the garage where TSOL practiced. And they said, well, sure, you can practice here. And we needed to get in a set, you know, because we were really obsessive about practicing. If we weren't playing, we're going to practice. Hauled our shit in, plugged in the guitar, hit a chord, all the power went out. Needless to say, his parents weren't amused. And then Jack goes, your guitar is louder than our whole band. And we're like, sorry, you know, sorry, man. And we just loaded out and that was the end. So I don't know. I can't remember how everything happened, but I do remember that. And I do remember that the guitar was louder than the band.
They couldn't deal with that Detroit ampage, you know, they're used to those California little amps.
Yeah, we were really into the ampage. Yeah.
Were you guys friends with the state at all? You're from Ann Arbor?
Oh, there's a guy named Art in that band?
I believe so. He was like a roadie for maybe the Stooges or MC5. There was some connection to the Stooges.
Okay. I think I'm aware of the band. I think for some reason I'm thinking they had a single, 7-inch.
They had a single, yeah.
The black cover?
Yeah. Yeah, that's good memory on that one.
It's as deep as I can go.
But I think they started in 78, but I don't think they really got it going till a little bit later. Like, I think that single doesn't come out till like 83, maybe.
Okay.
So what were some of your other takeaways from that first U.S. tour? Like some of the other places you guys were playing? Because it must have been like the scene's just really developing back home at this point for you guys. And you're kind of going around seeing all these scenes developing.
Yeah, it was really, really an eye opener. And we started off in Chicago at O'Banion's. And that just went fair because we'd played Chicago at Oz like in February and April. So here we're back in June and a different venue, and it wasn't as good a venue. Oz was really, really the deal. There was no Effigies on that bill, and those became friends, and especially John. And then we went down to Texas, went straight down to Texas and did the Houston, Austin, Dallas thing. Went great. The clubs down there, like especially Houston, Austin, were prepared for bands like this, where you could play as loud as you wanted and nobody was going to worry about it. And, you know, they let the kids throw shit at the band and, you know, you'd get hit with a beer can while you're playing. But like, okay, that's part of it. And then we went to Fort Worth and that was crappy. They weren't used to it. And so, you know, seeing these scenes, there was, you know, I mean, we weren't taking it in as much. We liked the bands. Like we met the Staines in Austin, stayed at their house. And they were really cool. They became friends. And, you know, for the most part, you're just watching everybody grow up. By the time you got to California though, everybody was really fully immersed. It was so much more developed. And to the point, everybody's younger and they were it was more developed. The scene was, there's more people to it. Everybody knew each other and it was fun, but it was also, it wasn't as fun because you weren't an outsider. It wasn't as outside, you know? And so we kind of go, oh, it's kind of mainstream out here, you know, playing in Fresno. And they even had this little thing called the Toyota Gang. Nice. All these were cool people. And they all drove these little Toyota pickups, which we had no idea how you afforded that because we're from Michigan, 16% unemployment and food stamps. You know, we're like, wow, how'd they get a truck? You know,
let alone multiples.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe it was, they were going with a fleet. Yeah.
It's like you're saying, it's so different in California, like the geographical way music is taken up is one of the most interesting things about it to me, but certainly in California, it is so much more popular the whole way through than it really is anywhere else. And you can kind of maintain, even except in LA, I guess, in during the mid 80s when violence became too heavy, but like there's always punk scenes in California in the way that I guess there's always punk scenes everywhere, but it just feels considerably larger to this day in California.
Yeah, I wonder if it's just because of sheer volume of people or just the allure. Maybe there's something more attractive to it there. But I know when we got there, I think we did Fresno, failed show. No, I think we did the failed show in L.A. and then I think maybe Fresno, then San Francisco. And San Francisco was really the hottest at that time, I thought, hotter than L.A., even based on the limited time we spent in LA. So what do I know? But they had great bands. I mean, we played on a bill with Middle Class, which had already eschewed its hardcore days. And I remember talking to one of the guys in the band, telling him how much I loved, you know, Out of Vogue and stuff. And he's like, wow, those were good days. Wow, man, I've already missed it. Shit. You know? And so, but there were really good bands playing there and tons of venues in San Francisco. And what Dirk was doing at the Mubuhay was fantastic. You didn't get paid shit, but what a great opportunity to go out there and play. I mean, I think we got $50. So, you know, you didn't eat. So, but that was normal.
Well, you helped inspire ska punk. Like, Jesse Michaels might not be doing this if he hadn't seen you guys first that day. So, you know, there you go. No Operation Ivy, no Fix tour.
I'll take it.
It is also on that tour. I think in Tony's book, you talk about playing with the Embarrassment in Oklahoma City.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We had been playing in Dallas, I think, and we went up a day early. I don't know if I told Tony this. We went up a day early to see The Fall. We were huge Fall fans, huge. And Fall in Oklahoma City in 1981. And they were great. And then afterwards we all stayed at the same house, except for Marky Smith, who stayed at a hotel. So we're like, we're going to have to talk to Smith. And no, that wasn't going to happen. The other guys were a lot of fun. Everybody got super drunk and drinking near beer. I think we had brought a bottle of booze with us from Texas. But anyway, everybody got really uproariously drunk. And back then you could get uproariously drunk, didn't matter, sleep in the next day. And then you're going to play a show. And the next day we played the same venue The Fall did. And there were like five people, you know. Oh, no. And but the Embarrassment played and they were great. And yeah. And the show we played fine, but for five people.
How far north did you guys go on that tour? Like on the West Coast?
West Coast. Oh, Seattle. Or Vancouver. Vancouver.
You guys played Vancouver.
A Smiling Buddha?
Oh, crazy. I don't think I've ever seen a flyer for that. That's insane.
Probably weren't any flyers because nobody was there.
Okay. Well, I would have been if I had a time machine.
Yeah, we're like, the weather was shit. I think we stayed at a place. I can't remember. This was truly the end of the tour. And we'd had a great show in Seattle, went up to Vancouver, and I think did two nights, maybe. And I don't think anybody was there. I don't remember it was dark and cold. And so we kind of reminded us of home. And we didn't want to be reminded of home. And that reminded us that we were going home. And so we did two nights there, and that was that. Had you been to the Smiling Buddha?
I've been outside of the old Smiling Buddha.
I remember it was a long, narrow room, but I can't be sure. And they had that beer, something, some kind of beer that was pretty good that we liked.
Molson?
No, it was Carlsberg.
Oh, Carlsberg, like the Danish beer.
Yeah, it was a Danish. It wasn't Canadian beer. Yes, okay. So is what we know.
I don't drink, so believe me, it's all wasted on me.
Okay, we drank a lot. We weren't picky.
I'm more into the other thing Vancouver has to offer, which is a lot of cannabis.
Yeah, at the time, I don't remember if they had that. I don't remember that. But we always had a lot of that, but we're going over the border, so.
Yeah. And then you guys just drove straight back to Michigan afterwards?
Yeah, we were out of money. We had eaten at a soup kitchen in Seattle, and we had some delicious hot dog stew, and then played a show that night at I don't know what the place was. Boy, it was a really good show. They gave us free beer. Some dude in the backstage spray painted the side of his shaved head with silver spray paint, which we thought was remarkable. And we were really impressed with everybody. And then we went up to Vancouver, and so we had no money. And we drove back straight through, I think, maybe. We must have just had gas. We were hungry. We stopped and stole for a little bit at one truck stop. And then we stopped in Montana and had some money wired to us to get the rest of the way. Remember, in some little town, and the sun was out in Montana, just waiting outside of Wendy's, because Wendy's used to have the salad bars. and you put all, you got a tray, just put all the food on the salad bar, all the food. You, instead of getting a plate, you would get the tray and just load that up with food. And so, you know,
we got to do on those tours.
Oh yeah, man. We were hungry. We were really hungry.
You said when you got back though, the scene had completely kind of changed, or not completely changed, but things had changed drastically in the scene.
Yeah. Yeah. It got much younger and the hardcore thing had really taken hold. And there were, there was something called straight edge, which we certainly didn't understand. And we're like, what's the purpose of this now? And I mean, now I see it, but back then, I mean, now, I mean, that's not the time to be straight edge. But yeah, it was kind of a younger crowd because we were older. I mean, at that time, I think we were 23, 24 years old. And so it was younger. So we definitely, and when you're 23 and somebody's 17 or 18, there's a big difference rather than when you're older, obviously. So we weren't understanding any of that. We didn't really want to. And so, but still the music was still great. But some of the newer bands were popping up too. I think Negative Approach, not quite at that point. I think the first time I saw them was November maybe of 81. I'm not sure. Oh, no. It was when we were doing Process, recording the Process.
It feels like the DC influence and Minor Threat. I guess Minor Threat's the one that kind of brings that West Coast style of hardcore back to the East Coast. At least that's what Rollins says in that America's Hardcore documentary. And it's really them that kind of go out and play these shows. I think when John was on the show, talked about playing in Windsor and their drummer getting beaten up because he bumped into Alec Mackay and got wolfpacked by all the DC guys. Like, it feels like there's a different collegiate kind of energy with the DC version of hardcore at that point.
Yeah, I didn't know much about it and didn't really follow it. I mean, it was a bad thing or anything. It was just that it wasn't interesting to me. I didn't want to fight. I had no interest in fighting anybody for why. I don't know why.
I think that's once again like a product of just the environment that a lot of kids have, where they feel that they've been picked on, and all of a sudden they now have a gang to kind of back them up, be it driving mini Toyotas or just moshing at a show. Like there's a comfort in numbers.
Well, go beat up the jocks that beat you up.
Yeah. I think that would probably be the better place to say, but
that makes more sense to me.
But they're way harder to beat up than the drummer from Negative Approach.
Yeah. Well, fuck that. Get a bunch of your friends and go beat that jock up, man. You know, yeah.
Was that the point when you guys were kind of like pittering out? Are you kind of doing Blight by this point, getting back from this tour?
No, we got back from that tour and we played shows intermittently. We would play a local show as soon as we got back. Then we played in at the Coronation Tavern in Windsor twice, a couple times. I think we played September and then December, and we were tuning up a little bit of new material. And we were rehearsing still pretty continuously, but by now we were down to muscle memory. We had the songs down pretty well. And, you know, we might change them around. Oh, we wrote No Idols and for the comp. And we weren't really petering out. We were ready for that tour in December then that we did. So we left December, I don't know, 11th or 12th and went down and played like Fayetteville, Arkansas. I can't remember all the dates we played on that. I think we played Phoenix and Tucson on that. And so again, a lot of San Francisco.
There was rumors of like another LP at some point that you guys, or an LP period?
An LP period, yeah. But we had started, I think we had about three songs in. And it was slower because, you know, you have that first batch of things you write and then... so it was slower coming. I think we might have done a couple of those songs, if not during the set, maybe in sound check. One song called Condition, which I don't remember much about anymore. I don't know that the direction was changing. It was probably changing, making it a little bit noisier because we'd seen Flipper and really liked that. And still to this day, one of my favorite bands. And so I think maybe it was going that direction. Craig was resisting that a little bit, but I don't know what it would have, you know, what direction we would have gone. But that tour, then we played our last show on New Year's Eve, San Francisco. Somebody told me later on that we play was us, Effigies. It was great to see them. They came out to San Francisco. We all got together and hung out. And then Dead Kennedys, Antipasti, Flipper, that show, New Year's Eve in San Francisco. Somebody told me later on that Chris Isaak played a late night set after that whole show. I don't know if it's true or not. Isn't that funny? I don't know.
Weird.
Yeah. I don't know.
Hard act to follow if you're poor Chris Isaak going up
maybe he just figured all the punks had gone home to, you know, to party and he had the place to himself. I don't know.
There's stories about Dwight Yoakam going to like Black Flag shows back then. There's like,
makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Music follows good music.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's like, but man, Chris Isaak, this is the first punk connection I think I've heard about Chris Isaak. I'm going to have to dig a little
bit. Don't know if it's true or not, but it was just something in a conversation that somebody said, somebody from San Francisco told me.
It's interesting as the early 80s kind of go in, you get that period about 83 and where it just seems like there's a huge, huge wave change that kind of hits punk. Like there's a bunch of bands that break up, a bunch of bands start doing new things. And out of that, you get like Dinosaur Jr. You get like Husker Du doing whatever they're doing at this point. You do get a lot of change. Was there thought of you guys trying to continue the Fix on at this point, or did it feel like it was kind of hitting a natural?
Well, what had happened was Jeff's dad, we played at Don Neal's. We played at a place called Don Neal's in Kalamazoo. I'm trying to remember who was on the bill. I know, I'm pretty sure L7 was on the bill. Violent Apathy were always good. Boy, they were consistently, Violent Apathy never had a bad show. They were like the Fix in one way. I think they were really dedicated to practice, so you could always tell every time they got better. It was Fix, Violent Apathy, L7, can't remember who else was on the bill. And we played, and Jeff's dad decided for the first time to go see him play. And Jeff was from kind of an upscale family in up north, northern Michigan. And his dad was, I think, a banker or something prestigious. And he saw that, and he saw the people running around. And I think, and I know Jeff, and so I should probably have asked him before I tell this story. But anyway, I think that was the end of the Fix. And I think his dad saw this mess, and he's like, no, this is not going to happen for my son.
Yeah.
So at any rate, when we then got back, Jeff said, I've got to finish school, blah, blah, blah. And that was fine. We tried out a couple people, but there is no way. Who's going to replace Jeff? And there's no reason to keep going.
Did you guys ever make it to Toronto?
Never. Never.
Yeah.
I don't know even, I can look in the trusty book, but I can't remember if we even had a number.
Jill Heath would have been doing shows like she did, but maybe like she managed Black Flag a little bit later on. And
okay. Maybe it was too early. Maybe too early. Maybe.
It might have been too early. But yeah, like I wonder. It's interesting because I guess Toronto does feel like slower on the uptake than Vancouver when it comes to the hardcore stuff. Like Vancouver was a much more organized scene.
Windsor, too, was ahead.
Yeah, you're right. But I guess that's Detroit, right? Feeding into that, too.
Detroit influence, right. I can't even remember if the initial Black Flag played in Toronto on those tours. If they would have given us a numbering, I'm sure Ken Lester would have given us a number. But no, never made it. Never made it east at all.
Which is interesting too, because like east would have been, but once again, I guess it was a little slower behind the times. But did you guys would have played DC, I imagine, though, right?
Would have. I mean, if they'd have had us.
Oh wow, you didn't even play DC. That's crazy.
No, we didn't. We just never made it. I think maybe we played Cleveland maybe once. But maybe very early on, but it was always south and west for us. I think we were just searching for good weather.
It's interesting how diametrically opposed the approaches of Fix and Necros are to punk and hardcore, even like where you guys are choosing to focus your touring on. Like the Necros are going east, as you guys are going west, and it feels like you kind of had different philosophies and wanted different things from punk rock. I think someone in the book from The Fix, maybe yourself, talks about how annoying those Necro guys could have been back then.
Well, they were kids.
They were kids, yeah.
And so that's all. It was just an age. I mean, because since Corey Rusk is still a terrific guy who I talk to semi-frequently, and he's just a great guy. And then Andy, I think, became a auto. He really knows cars, and I was an auto journalist for a while. And so we convened on that. And he's, you know, so, yeah, these aren't people that were, you know, that as you grow up, of course, the age difference doesn't really make any difference.
No, and the release party for your guys, 7 inches, you guys don't play, right? Just Violent Apathy plays.
Yeah, that was April of 81 at Club Doobie. Yeah, yeah. I don't know. And it wasn't even Violent Apathy. They called themselves Gradient, I think, at that time.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Before Violent Apathy.
Right, right. And that was a lot of fun. But I don't think there was anybody there for that either.
So what led to to Blight forming, like, at that point? Well,
after we broke up, Mike and I had a house in Lansing. We had had a house. When the Fix had a house, and then we went on tour and nobody lived anywhere, then we got back. And from when we got back from tour, nobody lived anywhere. And then Mike and I just got a house with a basement where we thought we could practice. But the Fix ended up practicing down the street at a church that had a stage. And so that was better for us. But anyway, we had a basement and no Fix. And I'd always wanted to play guitar. And so I got a Melody Maker, a 63 Melody Maker, for nothing. I had no money anyway, but so it had to be for nothing. And I don't know. We just started. Mike had all his gear. We had a friend who had a guitar amp. And we just started organically kind of just putting together these songs, you know, in the basement. And we got a guy who had done the sound for some of the Fix stuff. He was a drummer, Pat Clark. And these songs just started kind of coming together. And Tesco was a frequent visitor. And we're like, well, hey, you want to try this out? And he tried it out, and it really worked. And it was really a lot of fun. I really enjoyed doing that stuff. And we played some couple shows. And the first song I wrote was Blight. I had written the song. It was based on Guiding Light. I was watching the Guiding Light one afternoon and I had the guitar. I'm like, do, 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 do. I'm like, oh, I got to run and grab a recorder because I'll never remember this. That's so complex, right? And so I got the recorder and played it. And then we ended up doing that song. And that came out really good.
That record is awesome.
Recorded on a 4-track. So four of those, I think three or four, some of those tracks are on the reissue. That Touch and Go did. And then, I think that's the rest is semi-history. I went down and recorded that stuff at Corey's in Ohio. And Corey was learning how to use it was a 4-track. Maybe it was an 8. I don't know. He was really good. I thought the sound was great.
Would you guys mainly play with like L7, I guess?
Boy, our shows were limited. Our shows, let's see, we play open for the Bad Brains at a little place called Bunches in East Lansing.
How did that go over?
It was great. It was great. And the Bad Brains were terrific. They stayed at our house. They had a few shows in the area, so they stayed at our house. The great house guests, cleaned, cooked, the whole thing, smoked. It was really fun. Played ping pong every night in the basement because we had a ping pong table. And super fun. And they were really jealous of our yard. Oh, you got a yard. Yeah, but it ain't much, man. We don't have, you know. But and then I think we opened for the Circle Jerks at City Club. We opened a show. We played a show with, it was Negative Approach, Necros, Crucifix, Dead Kennedys at City Club. Three, I think maybe 5 shows total. You know,
that's it.
Yeah, that was it. It was short-lived. Tesco was getting married and moving to D.C. And that was August of 82. So that was it.
It feels like there's a lot darker records that begin coming out of Detroit. Like the scene starts getting a little more sinister. Certainly how they kind of portray it a little bit in Why Be Something That You're Not.
I don't remember that. I don't remember. Who, any band names that I might know?
A little bit later, but the stuff on Depression Records seems to be like really, there's like Boom and the Legion of Doom, who would bring the carcasses to their shows and throw the dead guts on the crowd.
Okay.
There's another band that was on Depression Records. I'm trying to remember. It has the most disturbing cover I've ever seen on a record. It's a photograph of a woman.
Slaughterhouse.
The Slaughterhouse 7-inch. Yes.
Love the Slaughterhouse. Yeah. Those are great. Those are really fun guys. They were just fun to be around. All of them. It was like a circus, you know? And really, really. I can't say enough good things about Slaughterhouse. Yeah. And Bob, the singer. Rest in peace. But.
I've heard stories about Bob, like they had a weird stage show that anyone who's talked about them on the show has been like scarred, both them and Boom and the Legion of Doom.
I wish I could remember more. I just know I love their music and I love Bob, and they were a train wreck and really entertaining, really loud, way overdriven basses maybe. Can't remember for sure. But Slaughterhouse were really, really cool band.
I like how I didn't even have to describe the 7-inch, and you knew as soon as I said the most disturbing 7-inch I've ever seen.
Right, disturbing cover. I'll bet Slaughterhouse.
There's a few also from Detroit that could take that crown for being the most disturbing record cover, but I do feel Slaughterhouse kind of rightfully has it.
Yeah, that makes me really happy that you brought them up. That just remembering that makes me happy.
Well, that's it. Like obviously your era and the era directly before and afterwards are so storied in the annals of punk rock, but that weird Detroit period, kind of like 84 to like the mid 90s, it's fascinating how bizarre it gets. Weird garage rock stuff too.
Yeah. I don't remember how connected I was. I mean, I'm sure it's a little blurry for some reason. I don't know why, that I was paying attention, but maybe not as much as I should have, but there was a band called ADC out of Grand Rapids, which is a fantastic, underrated band, really terrific. And that's another band that should be heard, but I don't think they ever had any output, really just a tape. But that was it. A great live band. They were like a guy singing through an amp, a drummer with no cymbals, Melissa, I think was her name, and then Scott, a bass player with an overdriven bass. And they were really noisy. And Charlie, the singer, would wave the microphone in front of the amp, and it'd be like, you know, the feedback would be part of the whole overall texture, the fabric of the band. They were really good.
Yeah, there's no like defined sound really from Detroit. Like if you're like, oh, this is the Detroit sound. Like obviously there's Detroit Motown sound, but even then there's so much sonic diversity within that.
So much, yeah. And I think... But later on at that period you're talking, I think even more so, because it was going in all kinds of directions. I don't even know. Again, I wasn't following a lot of that, so I don't know exactly what was going on. At that point, like 82, after 80, 83, I 83 was in Strange Fruit, joined Strange Fruit. And so I got exposed again a little more to a little more music. But I think in the down periods, I was doing other stuff. I don't think it was, I still play guitar. I don't think I was, you know, I had other interests, which were, you know, that wasn't necessarily musical.
I wanted to ask you about Strange Fruit a little bit because, you know, you, as you said, you heard Steve Shelley get punished about that band. I think a band that's super underrated and such a weird confluence of worlds, you know, you being in that band too.
Yeah, that was great. I really, really loved it. I knew met Steve. He was in a band that opened for The Fix in maybe October 1980 called No Zones or no, is it No Zones? No Zone. I can't remember exactly, but anyway. And he was in it with Scott Fagerson, who became the first bassist for Crucifix. And so I just always knew Steve and always seen him around and something, I guess it was spring of 83, he said Tim Folion, who was the guitarist in Spastic Rhythm Tarts in Kalamazoo, Michigan, was leaving. And Steve just floated the idea of me coming by and jamming with them. And they jammed at some place outside of town. And by then I had a car and amp and guitar and everything, really growing up. And went out there and played a few times, and it went well, and met Michael and Sherry. They were the part of the Strange Fruit. And it was really fun. And then Tim played a couple shows, both me and Tim on guitar. And then we recorded the single. And then we started doing dates. And that was a whole new crowd, a really good noise crowd. I got introduced to some new music and some really cool, I just started really appreciating noise. And it was so much fun playing with Steve, because we were more, much looser than the bands I was with before. And we didn't practice quite as much, but no matter how lost you would get, Steve would always bring it back. So you never really got lost, because he was so good. And we played shows, and we played a series of shows down in very psychedelic shows down in Texas, because the house we were staying at, we stayed, I can't remember the band, we got there, and there's a bag of freshly picked mushrooms on the table. And man, that really made for quite a trip.
And was it the band Meatjoy, maybe?
Yeah, that was it. Oh, wow.
Are you crazy? That's fucking insane.
Wow. How'd you know that?
Because Meatjoy is one of those bands that I'm kind of like weirdly obsessed with. They have like that one LP with handmade covers.
Right.
But maybe the most infamous thing about Meatjoy is that it's the band that features John Hawkes, who I believe won an Academy Award I'm trying to remember what movie now. He was in Eastbound and Down. A very well-known actor, but he was in Meatjoy.
Wow. See, didn't know. Maybe those were his mushrooms.
Might have been his mushrooms. You could have a future Oscar winner mushrooms circulating in your system.
It was quite a trip. And I think a photo, we played at a place in Austin. We played at San Antonio, Austin. I think we played Tulsa on the way down. That was a show put on by a guy from None of the Above, N-O-T-A.
Yes.
And maybe he just showed up and said hi to me, and I can't remember why. But anyway, that there's a picture somewhere, I think on Bandcamp, there's a Strange Fruit Bandcamp maybe. And there's a picture of us from that show in Austin. That was the last time I played. I think it was the last time I played with him.
That's awesome.
It was a lot of fun. We did the single the people were great. It was fun to play with them. And playing with Steve, but Kalamazoo had its own separate music scene, much different, I thought, than what was going on in Detroit on the east side of the state. It was just a little more arty, I would say, not less heavy, just more, more interested in things like the pop group and things like that.
But, yeah, like I feel like that's the great thing about punk too, is like after that first wave, when it starts kind of splintering off and people start doing different things with it.
Yeah. Yeah. It really fed your creativity, because you already saw what could be done. Right. So, well, and maybe your chops got a little bit better, ideally. Mm-hmm. And you understood, maybe how the process, the booking goes and what to look for. And none of us were very business savvy, but at least it did help you navigate that a little bit better. And we knew how to set up shows now, and we could do our own.
And I think that's also what keeps that hardcore scene healthy, is that these people kind of age out of it. They go on to do their own thing. They take the influence, maybe still play even the same sort of music, but it leaves that space free for a bunch of young people to come in and be like, no, we're the hardcore, and repeat that cycle.
Yeah. Yeah. And the more you can do it yourself and stay away from the corporations and keep all those, keep the grown-ups out, that's the best thing you possibly do.
Well, speaking of doing it yourself with or without the band's permission, the first Fixed record I ever heard was your Lost and Found release. What was the story behind that? Because that's a label that definitely has a dubious relationships with artists and their rights to their records.
Yeah, I know. And I'd like to remember more about it, but I knew those guys. I knew those guys somehow. And I think because at one point I had a little label called Go Ahead Records. And I think I did a couple things, and I'm trying to remember, I helped them distribute their records. And I think they did a Violent Apathy thing. They did these very beautiful nicely packaged things.
They did a box set, right? With like White Flag and
Impatient
Youth.
They were really good looking products. And I think you're right. And back then, again, the business sense wasn't very good. So you didn't know about who's doing what, who's just taking stuff without license. And I think they probably did. I don't remember how the Fix thing came about. I knew that that they wanted to do something, and I don't think they clearly didn't do it off the original tapes. They did it off, you know, some sort of bootleg tapes. By the way, I still have the tape, the Fix tape from Chillicothe, Ohio, from the night we got that tape that they give you when you leave the studio. I still have it, which is kind of funny.
That's amazing.
It still plays, but they didn't use that. Austin Fountain didn't use that. Touch and Go didn't use that. And I don't know what kind of distribution it got. I don't know. But the fact that you got it in Canada.
It got distributed all over the world. Like, they were a German. At a time when hardcore wasn't necessarily looked at as being a serious business by people. Okay. Like Touch and Go, I don't think was keeping a lot of these records in print back then. Recall, Negative Approach. The entrepreneuring German Lost and Found Records stepped into the void and made these records available.
Well, I don't know how many they sold, but how much are you gonna make? I'm not hurting for, I'm not gonna say, well, boy, I sure like that check now, but they were probably doing things that internationally you could probably do and get away with, and who's gonna get a lawyer in Germany? But they did good things. They put out good things. They made people aware of some good music. So maybe that's the purpose.
Was downtown Detroit, I obviously it was always pretty dicey and abandoned by the politicians, but like, did it get worse throughout the 80s into the 90s?
No, not that you'd notice. Cause I'd go to shows when I was in high school down at the Michigan Palace. It was right downtown. And it was bad. And we saw a guy get shot outside a Barry White concert at Olympia, just driving. We were driving back from a T-Rex show, and this guy just dropped. And we're like, whoa, did you see that? And we're like kids from the suburbs of Lansing, Michigan. We're like, whoa, we all just keep going, But you'd see that shit. And that was just part of what you grew up with. No, I don't think it got any worse. It didn't get any better. But it's one of those places that's never going to get any better, really.
It's interesting because the music gets harder as it goes on. Like, eventually by the late 90s, mid 90s, you got Cold as Life, Pitbull, Earth Mover.
Was Horse in that?
Horse, I don't know. Maybe they probably could be. Dogs of War is another band. Hate Inc.
Okay. See, I didn't, again, I wasn't living there then. So I really didn't know any of that kind of stuff. So I couldn't follow through on that.
There were shows at the Greystone that people say were some of the most terrifying.
Those were Corey's shows, right?
These were been later on, I think, as the Greystone kind of went to the next round of people.
I didn't know any of that. And I didn't go to the Greystone. I never went to the Greystone.
There were big time fights, I guess, with the bouncers. And then there was I think a big skinhead scene also popped up in Detroit around then, too.
See, again, I just didn't follow. You'd go to shows at Harpo's, and that was taking your life into your own hands. But, that's where one of the dudes, I can't say, some dude from the scene got murdered there in the parking lot. So, and when you went to Bookies, it was routine, even in the late 70s, it was routine to hear about people getting held up in the parking lot. So you just stayed close, were careful, watched it.
Yeah, the stories in Why Be Something That You're Not, even about the freezer and the other guy that ran the freezer, that was like kind of just a sketchy neighborhood dude.
Really? Okay. Yeah. That was a sketchy neighborhood, but all of Detroit was like that. I mean, most of Detroit was like that. Man, and you just never really thought about it, It didn't seem to me that it was something you'd think about. Like, oh, we really got to watch it. If it became sort of second nature.
That's why I'm like so glad you've done this book about the hyenas, because I feel like John is such a product of this environment and such a tribute to this environment. And there's like a, like, not, no disrespect to these guys, because they're like amazing singers, but like what Rollins and Nick Cave play at, I think John really is.
I think that's accurate. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when we were doing the Touch and Go book on Bazillions, you know, it was, we went through the, Tesco and I were going through the, what would be the cover. And it was like, well, why wouldn't we put Brannon on the cover? I mean, you know, he's the, he kind of is the rock and roll hero that, you know, you, at that point you didn't hear as much about. Now he's getting a little more recognition, but we're like, well, let's give him this recognition now. And that was 2010, I think. So.
Yeah. It's funny. Oh, go on. Sorry. Let me cut you off.
He was just the real deal. And we knew that anyway, just from knowing him.
It's like, I just had Dave Davies from the Kinks on, and we're talking about like the Kinks never being, they've always been like kind of like a working person's band. Cause they never really got, like, even though they got huge, but they never really had enough success that they could just kind of coast like the Beatles or something off the catalog. They're kind of like always working. And I feel like John's that for the hardcore singer, like where he still was washing dishes and still getting up and singing this band at a point when, like you're saying, now people pay respect to him. But at that point, very, only the most learned people were paying the respect that he deserved.
That's right. That's right. And so, and he deserves it. Definitely. I mean, he's like, yeah, he's definitely the kind of guy that Iggy Pop would have been if Iggy Pop wouldn't have rubbed shoulders with David Bowie.
Yeah, I was going to say, without David Bowie.
Yeah, yeah. We're very demanding. It's funny you mentioned that Dave Davies, wouldn't they coast on You Really Got Me?
I thought so too, but like they were constantly like working. Like he's like in his book, he constantly talks about how they had to kind of like go back and restart their career. And like they still had hits until like the 80s, right? Like they're still like writing these sort of like catchy songs, and they're, I don't know, they're harder to pin down to like one era, I think, because they're just consistently, you know, from You Really Got Me to Come Dancing, they're still like putting out, like churning out these records.
Yeah. I don't know, man. The number of people that covered, I mean, just the Van Halen royalty checks from You Really Got Me would probably keep you happy.
When did you start writing?
Your Flesh magazine, 1991. I knew a guy, David Livingstone, who was in the God Bullies. He was writing for Your Flesh, and he said, you know, he was at my house and I had all these books. He's like, oh, you like to read? I said, yeah, yeah, I like to read. And he's like, oh, you know, and he knew I knew about music. And he said, well, hey, would you like to do this? And I said, well, I've never written before. I don't know shit about writing. And so he fixed me up, and with Peter Davis, the publisher. And that's how I started. And I couldn't write for shit. Go back and look at that shit. It's terrible. And then I just kind of moved forward. It was funny. My father was a journalist and a journalism professor. And I hadn't gone to college or any shit like that. But I didn't start to understand my way around the word. And so I always loved reading. And so it would just became uber passion. And then I realized that they paid you for it, which was even weirder. You know, I was like, really? You could get money for this? And that became, you know, it was very gradual. I didn't understand normal life very well.
What led you to writing about true crime stuff?
Let's see. I covered courts. My first job, newspaper job, I covered courts and covered murder trials. And I was like, that, you know, I just thought that was a wild thing. Because all the legal parts and all the parts where you had to put a case together, and then you had the crime itself. Just fascinated by it. And eventually it just came around to the opportunity presented itself. I had written a story for People magazine on a crime that happened in Michigan. And somebody from New York called and said, you want to do a book? And that happened. And then after that, you say, well, you want to do another book? And then you do with books until they tell you, we don't want any more books.
What's your take on kind of what's happened to true crime in sort of the last, I don't know, 10 years, maybe, like podcast boom, Netflix true crime documentary. Like, how do you think it's changed the world of covering kind of crimes like that? Or has it?
Well, covering the crimes is still the same because the facts and the perps are still the same and the justice system's pretty much the same. The sensationalization, I'm guilty of it, but part of that would be the history, which is we all want to have history in our lives. That's what we do. The bookshelves are filled with history books. But then there's a sensationalization that came from videos and so on. And then some of the series you'd see on TV. I did a little writing for True Crime TV, and it was terrible. And the people didn't know anything. And so people were maybe getting a misrepresentation at some times. But then you look at Netflix and some of the great, I was watching the Lori Vallow series on Netflix and thinking, that's just so well done. That really gives you an idea of what happened and how this happened. So there's certain shows. It's just like everything else. There's some good books, some bad books. There's some good shows, some bad shows. But I don't think it's changed, the fact that somebody did something wrong and they probably need to be caught and justice administered.
Obviously, outside of like the major differences between the subject matter, what's the difference between writing about music versus doing true crime stuff?
I don't know. The best music is usually made by criminals.
Very true.
So that kind of helps a lot. And so I think it's there's two different forms of low life, right? And they're both, one is really bad and one is really good.
Yeah, that's why punk's fascinating to me, because it's like that highfalutin, highbrow art school pretension meets juvenile delinquent street rock and roll. And that's
Yeah. And remember, there were people who would try to intellectualize punk rock. They'd write these terrible like essays and so on, and what it all means and so on. And generally it just meant somebody was trying to be understood at the end of the day.
Exactly. And it's like religion, right? Like everyone's going to have their own interpretation on what this is and what this should be doing.
Sure. Yeah. And their own take on it and their own hopes for it and what it does to them. And again, I go back to courage and comfort.
Well, anytime, Steve, you want to come back on this show and talk about punk art, what courage and comfort, or next time we just got to do a whole episode about the Laughing Hyenas, I guess.
Sure, that's fine, man. Yeah, I appreciate your time today. Thanks for putting me on.